4.3 million Filipino-Americans who are either born in the U.S. or are reported to have Filipino ancestry. This podcast will feature the Filipino diaspora in the United States, tracing their origin stories and accompanying them in their journeys. Their stories will be as diverse as the dialects and subcultures of the people from across the 7,641 islands that comprise the Philippine archipelago. Some will be inspiring, others pleasant, and a few, well, cautionary. Welcome to 4 Million Filipinos, the Filipino-American Experience.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to 4 Million Filipinos, the Filipino-American Experience. It's the podcast where we talk about Filipino-Americans and their origin stories. And today we are doing a episode part two, right, Bing? This is part two of a multi-part show. We have with us returning Cindy Scott, who is the author of the book Never Forsaken, which is a story about her mother's life. Growing up in the Philippines, and then how she came to the United States. And so I do need to make a correction, because when I was introducing Cindy last time, I cut some years off of her marriage. So I said that they have been married for 25 years, but it's double that. It's 48, basically. So don't mean to shortchange. I hope your husband's not mad at me.
You shaved off a couple of decades, huh?
Yeah, I did. Okay. So, hey, Bing, how's it going?
Oh, everything's fine. Everything's fine right now. Let me just give you just a bit of context. As you're hearing this right now, the local elections, the campaign season is starting officially right now. So,
Oh boy.
It's going to be, let me just use this term euphemistically, it's going to be fun.
Is that why everything is pink on Facebook? I mean, I've seen everybody's Facebook feeds, and there's just pink everywhere.
I'm colorblind right now. All right. All right. Enough of that. But that's the context right now. So
that's right.
It's fun. It's fun. I think, you know. So there.
We'll go back to the story. Skip the politics for now. I might have to pin you back on who you're voting for later, but. So, Cindy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And let's pick up. We were, I think, the last part of the story, you were talking about how the teacher walked into the classroom and said, "We are now a nation at war." This was in the Philippines, right? And this is right at after Pearl Harbor. And then they came and they went after the Manila, right? Was it another?
Correct.
It's crazy. I mean, I think we're all, everything's on top of mind because of the Ukraine invasion. So this kind of hits home. And so I think it's also timely to talk about just what it was like. So,
And I guess it's a bit more real, because right now, well, Cindy's taking us through this experience from her words and using her mom's recollections of it. And we're blessed with that. I was told by an English teacher that there is nothing just more powerful than words, because you're the one who imagines what's happening. But, you know, as we try to imagine what was going on at that point, we're really seeing something similar play out on live television right in front of us every single day. And you know, it's heartbreaking seeing it. But, you know, it gives us, again, an idea of what was going on from a time that has, you know, that for this generation at least, is already long and forgotten.
Yes. Do you want me to pick up?
Yes.
Please.
So what happens next?
So that day, when the teacher said that, it was complete silence in that room. I mean, you could hear a pin drop on that wooden floor in that school room, because they were so shocked. And, you know, they didn't know when they would ever see their friends again. This could be the very last time. So what she did, her roommate went back to the dormitory, packed their things. They crossed that angry Agus River. Remember me talking about that Agus River? Yeah. It kept on roaring. She had to cross that river, take the bus, 13 miles back to Mamungan, got off the bus and walked 2 miles back to the plantation. Now, remember, this is December. You know, when there was a school break, it would be almost Christmas time, a really happy time of year. Mm-hmm. So there was no way her mother knew she was coming home. So when Lola, her mom, saw her walking back to the plantation nearing that door, she was shocked. Why would Marion be coming home at this time? Wow. Remember, they had no news of the war. They had not received. They're on a plantation. You know, it was by word of mouth at that time. So by that time, you know, Marion told her mom and the workers on the plantation what happened. War had broken out. And my mother had a sister still living at home whose name was Pearl. Just a little bit older by mom. But she lived at home because one day when my mother was 5 years old, Pearl was on the second floor of their plantation. The window was open and Pearl fell out the window, landed on the ground. And then from then on, her mind was like a child. So her rest of her adult life, she never regained that ability to grow into an adult. So after that, she was on the plantation, and just a couple months later, the U.S. Army actually came and took over their plantation, commandeered it, and made it into their headquarters. Because the plantation was full of coconuts. It was like a camouflage for them from the Japanese planes. And remember, they had 38 head of cattle, pigs, and animals, and fruit. So there was food for the army, you know, to feed them. So just picture this, this beautiful plantation, and then the U.S. Army takes it over, and then they actually had to leave the plantation. But before they did, my Lola and my mother, Marion Gent Jose, by the way, Marion Gent at the time, took their valuables and they buried it in the ground, in the yard. Okay. The only things when they left the plantation that Lola had on her were my grandfather's military discharge papers and her marriage certificate, because later on after the war, it was what made her way into the U.S.
That those papers are you know, those were literally her ticket to the U.S.
Yes. So that was December, you know, again, December 8th, World War II had started, and the Japanese actually invaded the Philippines on December 10th. And on December 11th, Germany and Italy declared war against the United States, and that's actually when World War II began.
And how old was your mother at this time?
Yes, she was 15 years old. She had just turned 15 3 months before, on September 13th. 1926. She was born in 1926. So she was 15 years old. So imagine yourself as a teenager. Very fast.
I can't even fathom what that's like. My grandfather used to tell me about that time and how they buried stuff in the yard and then they ran to the hills. They went to the mountains. Like that was one of his stories that he would tell all the time. And it didn't register in my head until I got older, right? It was just... Wow, you know, think that way.
Yeah.
The other thing which you know just dawned on me right now. These things are the Ukraine invasion, for example. We're seeing it, but there was prior. You could see the buildup to it, in a sense.
Right. Yes.
You could see the tension. So when it finally hits you, it's not one surprise. It's not one huge surprise that just it's like someone taking the rug from underneath you. But I can imagine right now what it must have been like when people just hear, "Yes, we're in war," and why? What happened all of a sudden that we're in this war? Because at that point, you know, news we're right now spoiled for media. We're updated every single second what's going on, so we know. In a sense, we were actually waiting for things to happen. But over there at that time, particularly where they were, there was no media. So for those of you who are listening to it and you're a bit younger, that is just, game changer is a very lousy cliche, but that's just what it is. Everything just changes right at that
instant. You need to appreciate the fact that you see things in real time, whereas Cindy's mother shows up at home and they're like, what are you doing home? You should be at school.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's why.
Yeah.
And that's why when you say she had to grow up pretty fast, there's no time to grow up because news is brought there right smack in front of you. And there was no inkling that this was about to happen for many of them.
None at all. In fact, I don't even think she knew where Japan was at the time.
Yes, yes. I can
imagine. Of course, they were taught geography and, the war in Europe, it didn't really happen until December 11th. I mean, it was going on, but she had no idea what was going on across the world, really on the European continent.
What also strikes me is pivotal is the fact that the U.S. Army came and took over the plantation. Like, that also must have been the scariest thing you've ever seen. I guess the Americans were stationed in the Philippines for a while anyway. Right? Like, they must have known the Americans
at that point
as an army position. But was your mom?
Yes, they were.
Afraid of the Americans? Feel like a comfort level because they were there to save or protect the Philippines?
Well, first of all, her father was an American veteran. Mm-hmm. So he had already fought in the Spanish-American War, fought in the Philippine-American War. So she was familiar with that. But later on, the Japanese actually took over their plantation, later on, because the Americans were forced to flee into the hills of Mindanao.
Right. And, well, let's talk about that, because that's the next step in the chapter is when Manila falls, which, I mean, that's just like Washington, D.C. falling for us, right? It's the capital of the Philippines, right?
Yes, actually, there is a parallel story in these next several chapters. First of all, I want to tell you this book is historical, biographical, and inspirational. There's a lot of history in it. So if you're an adult or a teenager, you will learn a lot about World War II and the Philippines. Mm-hmm. It's such a diverse culture, being, as you mentioned earlier, diverse, which I love that word because it reminds me of the Philippines being under Spain for 350 years. And then it became an American colony in 1898 and didn't really actually receive its independence from the U.S. until 1946. So it was an American colony for a long, long time. And the schools, the educators came. But anyway, yes, there was an American camp called Camp Keithley that was actually built on the ruins of Fort Marawi, which the Spanish took over from the Moros in 1898. So that's a piece of history you probably don't know.
I didn't know that. That's right.
So yes, there was a camp, Camp Keithley, and that was actually where the high school was. The high school that my mom went to and all her siblings went to was on Camp Keithley, and it was called the Now High School. And Don Stalin was across the river.
There's so many ways to appreciate it for this story. Yes, you're right. It's it's a historical. It's obviously a biographical story at the same time, as you mentioned, it's also an inspirational story. Take us through that, Cindy. I mean, we've established that it must have been a weird, crazy, unimaginable time, particularly for your family at that point. But what got them through that initial stage? I mean, I'm sure there was that whole shock and awe of the entire thing. But what was the next step? What got them through that period?
Well, I have to tell you, my mom, as I was growing up, she had a very, very strong faith in God. And she shared that with us. But even throughout the book, it's very real. It's not just something that she writes about. It's not just words. But as we go through the book, you will find that they were so grateful for just anything, you know, for food or for the sun to come out that day. It was always a spirit of thankfulness. Yes, there were times of depression when they were POW. So if you don't mind, I can go back. Actually, after she goes to the plantation, the army takes over. Mm-hmm. Marion, my mom, and her mother and sister went back to Dunsallan. I keep saying Dunsallan. I'm sorry we don't have a map here for others to look at, but it's where the mission dormitory was, and it's, her sister lived on the ground. So they fled the plantation, left it, and went to Dunsallan, and lived with her sister at the time. A lot of missionaries and their families, a lot of Americans, Catholic priests.
Yeah.
They were all arriving in Dunsallan, trying to flee the Japanese. So you can just picture these crowds of different groups of people all coming into this village. And my mom lived with her sister. They had a home on the mission grounds, and they built an air raid shelter actually underneath the house. And she writes about when they could hear the planes coming and the bombing started, they would go into that air raid shelter. And of course, air raid shelters are so small. And when the bombs hit, the dust just starts coming out. And she had this fear because they had heard stories about Japanese taking young girls out of the air raid shelter and taking them and raping them. And so she had this fear of that shelter door being opened by them. And, you know, it became such a routine going to the air raid shelter that her niece and nephew, who were 3 and 4 years old, when they heard those bombs falling, they would go straight for the air raid shelter. You didn't even have to tell them to go there.
Wow.
It became a way of life for a few months. Mm-hmm. When the bombs came, and yes, and the planes, the Japanese planes were bombing that city.
The fact that they, I mean, again, it seems so alien to me. Just, I remember when we grew up, we had the air raid sirens and they made us hide in the hallways, right? I mean, that.
Yes.
It was, we had to hide from nuclear bombs in the hallways of our school and hide under our desk. Now, granted, I think we know a lot better now that that's just not going to save you. But, you know, that always terrified me in elementary school and even in high school. You know, it just was one of those things you lived with. But I can't. Your mom must have been so strong in her faith and in just understanding that she was going to be okay, that she would, like you said, she would just do it. It was part of the habit that they have. It was, you know, you hear these stories about people finding God and things like that in the worst case scenarios, like the life-threatening situations. Your mom, though, was raised that way. So it was her way of life. It's not like she found God because she was in World War II. She was always in the faith, right?
Yes, she was always. Mm-hmm. And that's just what kept them going. I mean, through the book, you will hear her say that. Mm-hmm. And it's because it was a part of her life. You know, it was true faith. Mm-hmm. And remember, her father, who was a coal porter for the American Bible Society, would read the Bible to them. They would sing hymns. There were a lot of times when they were together, and we'll talk about that in the POW camp, was all they could do. You know, they would sing their hymns, they would pray, they would reminisce about life on the plantation, because there was not a lot of things for them to do at the POW camp. Those were the things that they did to survive. And today you will hear stories of the POWs from Vietnam, who were in Vietnam, that how they survived. Well, mom was a POW at the POW camp. And they were there for a year. And I talk up in the book about their escape, you know, how they got to the camp. So a little bit, if you don't mind, shall I go on about
telling you how they got to be
a POW?
Yeah.
So at the time, they had gone to Don Salin. They heard the Japanese were coming. So their group, there was a group of Americans, and her brother-in-law led the group. And I'm going to mention this name right now, Dr. Frank Laubach, L-A-U-B-A-C-H. At the time, he was the third educator in the whole world. He happened to be a missionary to the Philippines and wanted to teach the Moros how to read and write. You see, the Moros did not have a written language at the time. They just had an oral language. And he wanted to teach them how to read and write. He came up with a program on how to do this. And he taught the Moros how to read and write. He was the first person. And her brother-in-law was his assistant, his right-hand man. But Dr. Laubach actually, as the years went on, founded Laubach Literacy. He taught 100 million people in the world how to read and write through his program. Wow. He was my grandfather's best friend. So my mom grew up with him. After her father died, Dr. Laubach was one of the men who took care of her and their family. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Laubach knew the Moros. So they decided to go into Moro land, and the Sultan friend of Dr. Laubach actually took care of them and helped them. They took boats. They drove actually from Lake Lanao into Moro land, deep into Moro land where it's all Moros. Mm-hmm. Now, the Moros fought, you know, the Americans. I mean, they fought the Spanish, the Americans, and the Filipinos. Mm-hmm. But for the time being, they were safe with the Moros. I didn't know if you wanted to say something.
Are the Moros Christian or Muslim? No,
these are the Muslims.
These are the Muslims. Yes. Actually, right. The Moro is the word for Muslim, and the Spanish gave them that name.
Yes. Yes. Because these are the Moors of you know, that's the how the Spanish understood them. They were the Moors of you know, for the Spanish. And that in itself is, I just like to touch on that a bit, because you know, we started to get into the faith of your mom, and this is also an interfaith story in a sense. Your mom as a daughter of a Bible toting you know, of a coal porter, was Christian. They were under attack right now, and in a sense, they found solace with Muslims, which was quite unthinkable even at that time.
Yes.
Because really, it was a protracted period of war, in the sense where, you know, the Christian who were represented by the Spanish were at war with the Muslims. And
yes.
Then the Americans, who again represented the Christians, were also at war with the Muslims. But then, you know, there was a third party here, another enemy, and that's where, you know, these erstwhile combatants, if you may, they may not have been personally at war with each other as people, as individuals at that point, but you know, the groups that they were part of were in conflict with each other, and all of a sudden, you know, they come together and they find solace in each other, in a sense, protecting each other at that point, bringing them deep into what the Spanish and the people at that time called the Moro land, as you say. Mm-hmm. And that was the heart of what is now, you know, what is now Muslim Mindanao. And
yes,
that in itself is quite a touching story, because really you find solace in some of the strangest places, places you probably do not expect to find it, but there, even amongst people you perceive to be initially as your enemies, you find that they're the ones that you can run to, and that was probably a strange twist to that part of history.
It was actually. Now, Dr. Laubach, who I mentioned earlier, had a good friend, the Sultan. in Morrowland. He's the one who gave them refuge as they went into Morrowland. He provided a home for them. You know, one of those houses that the walls just come up halfway. They actually had to climb a ladder to get onto the first floor. You know, they cooked underneath. So it was what you called a long house. It was what they called the Morrow houses back then. So he gave them a safe place to stay. But there were a lot of other Morrows who wanted to kill them because they were Americans.
Right.
Yeah.
So in the end there, they decided that they needed to leave Morrow Land and go back into Dunsalon and surrender to the Japanese.
Wow.
That was a very, very difficult choice to make. So what they had to do was they had to get these bancas, which are those kind of the boats with a little bamboo top on it, the boats. The Sultan helped them escape to flee from Morrowland because it was bad. The Moors wanted to kill them, including the Sultan. Other Moors wanted to kill the Sultan because he was giving the Americans, giving them a safe refuge. So one night, the boats were hidden on the lake. Mm-hmm. And they actually hid in the marsh. And there were some American soldiers with a machine gun. And during the night, the one of the leaders would say, go. And each of them would run from a house to the boat. And the American soldiers with the machine gun would keep them safe because Moros were already shooting at them. Wow. Just for them to get to the boat. And my mom said that was the most horrifying, terrifying experience to be shot at. When it was her turn and they said it, her go, she ran from that one place, one longhouse, to the boat under gunfire. She jumped into the boat and she landed on top of another person in the banca.
Wow.
So just picture this. It's not a movie. This is not a fiction novel. This is a true story of what happened at that time. Now, you can just picture this, getting into the boat, and it is dark. And they have to stay in the boat until morning so they can actually cross the lake back into Dunsalon and surrender to the Japanese. Now, in the meantime, I will tell you that when my mom left the plantation, her older brother named David was going to join the Philippine Army and decided not to, of course, became a guerrilla, actually, on Mindanao. Mm-hmm. And he has some amazing stories about being a guerrilla on Mindanao, how he fought, how he would drive priests into villages so priests could conduct masses and marriages during the war.
Wow.
And they never knew where he was, but he always seemed to show up at the right time. And as the book goes on, you'll hear those stories about him. But yes, so picture this right now. Okay, they are crossing the lake. Daytime, they cross the lake. They land on the shore in Dunsalon, and the Japanese army meets them on the shore.
You know, that is the equivalent of a rock and being in between a rock and a hard place.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's the lesser of two evils, really.
That's what she said, actually, which was the lesser for them of two evils, because really they were gonna their thought dies eventually somewhere, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So you just choose which one is it. Is it the
you have
present,
to throw yourself on the mercy
present danger
of
right now or
one of these groups. Or, it's yeah.
And in during this time, it was her mother, her, and there were just six females in the group. There were six of these females. And my mom's, the rest of her family were scattered actually all over the Philippines. And there is a parallel story in the book about her brother-in-law in occupied Manila. And I can talk about that too. But if you have a couple questions, we can I can answer them for you.
I'm just riveted because it's like this is unfolding in my head on what's going to happen next. And, you know, just the fact that you have to run in the dark, no lights, gunfire over your head, and then, mm-hmm. you know, you land in this boat and you have to wait till the boat leaves. So you're, again, still waiting to be safe. And that kind of mental strain, I can't even. And she's 15. She's 15 years old.
Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. And she's taking care of her mother and her sister, right?
Yes.
So she's kind of a grown up in a 15 year old body in the middle of war. So
you know what, Manolo? Mm-hmm. Our world today, where we take information for granted, in the sense that, you know, it's all around us. We know what's happening everywhere to everyone, right? You know, in real time, as you mentioned. But what really is, I guess what was, I'm trying to imagine how it was then. What was so difficult was that you just didn't know what was going on around you.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, you didn't have a concept. You know, we like to say right now, oh, you got to see the bigger picture. There was no bigger picture because you had no source of information. What was going on?
That's right.
There was no internet at that time. So
yep.
What was going yep. on? And a lot of it was really, I guess it had to be faith that just drives you because, you know, faith in common sense. A lot of it was in that choice that you make. Where do you go right now? Where there are bullets flying past you and they want you dead right now? Or mm-hmm. do you move into a prison camp where that death may be imminent, but hey, at least it's still some time in the future.
Yeah, you're buying time. That's really what it is.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes. Yep. Well, when go ahead, Bing.
No, and we can't seem to imagine that right now because, again, we live in a, even this, I'm watching television footage right now of I just can't imagine how Zelensky could actually be tweeting and at the same time, you know, these things are unfolding and yet people are getting news about what's going on. We're getting footage, live footage mm-hmm. in real time of what's happening. So the world can see, and you also know what's going on around the world. You know how people are reacting to what's going on. But again, during that time, there was an absence of that at all. And, you know, this whole cliche, it's you and me against the world, that was it. You were just lost somewhere there. What was clear and present was probably just that patch of land that was directly visible in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that field of view, that was your reality. And you had to decide based on what was in that, you know, field of view, in that reality of yours.
Yeah. There's another thing I'd like to clear up. When you say guerrilla, and you know, it's my ignorance about the whole Philippine history, but that's basically what they call insurgents. Like they are the ones that are, it's guerrilla warfare, right? They hide in the shadows and they basically are the resistance. Is that correct?
Actually, General MacArthur,
mm-hmm.
After the war started, he had already formulated a plan to have a resistance movement on Mindanao and the Philippines. And as you know, he left the Philippines to go to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where... When he uttered those famous words, I shall return.
In fact, in my home today, I have a plaque that has my grandfather's medals from the Spanish-American War,
mm-hmm.
his veteran's card, but also the original leaflet that my Lola picked up that says, I shall return. That she picked up during the war when they dropped those leaflets over the Philippines.
Manolo, for those of us who work in the media and information industries, Man, you can imagine what that was. So that was propaganda being used at the war, and they were flown, they were dropped out from planes, leaflets.
That's the only way to get the word out back then, right? I mean, really.
It was the only way. I guess you would call it psychological warfare today, you know what I mean? Yeah. But anyway, so back to the camp. I'll just tell you. So when the boats landed on Donsal on the shore, the Japanese were there. And of course, they didn't speak English, and Mom and her group didn't speak Japanese, but they just gestured to them to get out of the boats. And so they got off the boats, and then the Japanese army, the soldiers, motioned to them to follow them down a road and took them down a dirt road in Donsalon into the POW camp, which was formerly Camp Keithley. Can you imagine that? That's where she went to high school just a few months before. She was going to school right there in Camp Keithley. And now they're POWs at Camp Keithley.
Yeah.
It's so hard to picture, you know. Mm-mm. So they ushered him into the camp one by one. And remember, they haven't had any food, nothing to drink because, you know, they couldn't drink the lake water. No food. But they still tried to be thankful. You know, even if this helplessness, what can you do? You feel, you can't do anything. You feel helpless in a situation like this.
Right.
I'm sure they all wanted to cry and they all wanted to go to sleep because they were so exhausted. So that's how actually they got into the POW camp, is they surrendered to them.
Unbelievable. So I can't even, at any point in time, did your mom just kind of break down during this time?
Yes. I can't.
I'm sure she did.
Yes, she talks about them crying and feeling helpless. And but yet at the same time, being thankful when they got a bowl of rice and rice broth, because the Japanese only fed them once a day.
Wow.
And it was just a little bit of rice and rice broth. And eventually, they all lost so much weight. And just think, she's 15 years old, okay?
Right.
5'2", normally she weighed 112 pounds. But they all were so thin, they lost a lot of body mass because they didn't have any food to eat. And, you know, every morning she talked about hearing bonsai outside their little house, wherever they were kept on the camp. And the soldiers would have their bayonets, and they would be practicing and walking down. And occasionally, they would stick the bayonet into their door just to make sure they were still there, you know. But that's how daily life for them was like in the POW camp.
Wow. And I'm sure her mother, who's older, you know, I think when you're younger, you're stronger. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yes.
Was also probably, she was probably watching her mom waste away. I mean, I know even today I worry about my mother and how she's doing. She's getting older. So, you know, watching your family members suffer and trying to keep their spirits up all the while you have this mental strain on you. I'm sure that's probably what is the foundation for what your mom was like, right? A very strong woman.
Yeah. And she was actually through all the years. Mm-hmm. Her mother was 57 years old at the time, and I'm way older than that now. So I can imagine what it was like. But now during the same time, remember things were happening in Manila. So her brother-in-law was a young lieutenant in the Navy when the bombs actually were dropped by the Japanese, and he was in Manila, and there were 12 torpedo boats that were actually bombed out by the Japanese, and two other torpedo boats survived that bombing, and it was those two boats that actually took General MacArthur to Mindanao, to Corregidor first, and then to Mindanao. Can you imagine? Those two torpedo boats that were left. So mm-hmm. his name was actually Juan Magluin, Lieutenant Juan Magluin. Mm-hmm. And he eventually became a POW in Manila. And he survived part of the war. And Manila had fallen actually in 1942. Remember, there was no food coming in. Food supplies were short. And it's a story in the book. I hate to go through all the stories that he's gone through as a POW. Mm-hmm. But eventually, he ends up at the same camp where all the prisoners from Bataan, the march from Bataan, all mm-hmm. ended up at Camp O'Donnell. Well, wow. he ended up at the same camp with them. And there are stories in the book that how he survives, you know, being a POW and how he survives occupied Manila, but also the day when the Americans return. So that's kind of something maybe we can cover a little bit later. I don't know if you want, I can do that a little bit later, because we're also going to go into when they actually leave the POW camp. They escape. My mom escapes with her Lola and her sister and a couple others, and how they leave that and go into the run, into the forest, and they live in the forest for 3 years, and how they flee the Japanese almost day to day or week by week for the next 3 years. So the way they escape from the camp is that one day her brother-in-law, who was also a prisoner with them, decided to come up with an idea. Mm-hmm. He talked the Japanese commander into letting him go out for a week into their old home and see if there were any belongings left. After a week, he comes back with these men. And my mom and her sister and Lola had no idea who these men were. Mm-hmm. He told the Japanese soldiers that these men were the husbands of these women and that they had been given a permit to leave the camp and go back to their house.
Wow.
To their farm. Mm-hmm. Well, the Japanese soldiers, there was only two ways out of the camp. Out of Dunsalan, one gate from Camp Keithley, mm-hmm. and then a road out of Dunsalan. So the Japanese soldiers stopped them at the gate. My brother-in-law knew a few Japanese words, and this is a miracle. This is a miracle. The Japanese soldiers let him through.
Wow.
And then that's how they escaped. And the next few chapters are how they make the run. That's a miracle in itself.
Yeah. Well, it's also perfect timing because we're ending on a good note because they get away and we have to end our show now. So you're perfectly, I always like to end on a nice thing, right?
It's okay.
Like,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, the thing was pretty heavy already.
Yeah.
especially
I was like, are they going to make it? Are they going to make it? And you're like, yes, they made it.
Especially right now, let me put it this way, you know, mm-hmm. this is a two continent podcast right now.
Yes.
So I'm just starting my day, and I'm telling you, that was pretty heavy already.
Right?
As I started, so I am so glad that we ended up on this spiritual high, so to speak.
Yes.
Right. That's right. They make their escape. So just picture them going through the guard gate with the Japanese and their bayonets and letting them through. And they have no shoes. They're barefooted because they have no shoes. They had just the clothes that they're wearing. And they get through, and then they will be on the run.
Right. Well, they get through by tricking the Japanese, which is even crazier.
Yes.
It's like you said, it's a miracle. It's like
it's a miracle.
These are not the droids you're looking for. Let us go. It's like good grief.
And this is not a novel. This is not a story I came up.
It's
this
true
is
story.
A true story.
You know, there's that other God. You know, there's that other cliche. You can't make this up.
No,
you can't.
It is true.
Right, right. And and with that, I'm glad we could end on a good note. I mean, the good news is they were able to leave. They escaped from the camp. So now we get into what it was like. But that's going to be the next show. Yes. So you'll have to tune in again.
Exactly.
So I'm going to start the exiting music. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. I hope you were just as riveted as we were. And the good news is they escaped. So the good news is they escaped. But then we're going to hear more because there's a lot more of the story. How they got away, what they had to do. But thank you so much for listening to us. And join us again next week.